Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Life is suffering. Right. Indisputable. What do you do about that? You voluntarily accept it and then strive to overcome the suffering that's a consequence of that. And you do that for you, and you do that in a way that makes it better for other people. And then that works. And one question might be, well, how well does it work? And the answer is, the only way that you can find out is by trying it. That's it. That's the existential element of it. The proof is to be derived by the incarnation of the attitude in your own life. No one can tell you how it will work for you. It's the thing that your destiny is to discover that. And you have to make the decisions to begin with. It's like, because you can't do this without commitment. You have to commit to it first. That's the act of faith that Kierkegaard was so insistent upon. You have to say, I'm going to act as if being is good. I'm going to act as if truth is the pathway to enlightenment. I'm going to act as if I should pursue the deepest meaning possible in my life. And there's reasons to do none of those. They're real reasons. So it's really a decision. But you can't find out what the consequence of the decision is unless you make the decision. I think the same thing happens when you get married, by the way. So if you think you might leave, you're not married. And then you think, well, the marriage didn't succeed. It's like, well, maybe you were never married. Because the rule is, you don't get to leave. And there's a reason for that rule. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't situations where there should be exceptions made for that. That's not the point. The point is that there's some games you don't get to play unless you're all in. And the other thing that's so interesting about being alive is that you're all in. No matter what you do, you're all in. This is going to kill you. So I think you might as well play the most magnificent game you can while you're waiting. Because do you have anything better to do? Really? Why not pick the best thing possible that you could do? Why not do that? Maybe you could justify your wretched existence to yourself that way. I think you could. That's what it looks like. You know, people find such meaning in the responsibilities they adopt, it stops making them ask questions about what life is for. If you have a newborn child, for example, like unless you're really in a bad way, psychotically depressed, or maybe your personality really needs some retooling, you stop thinking about anything but ensuring that that baby is doing well. And if someone comes along and asks you an existential question about your commitment to that, the right response is, why are you asking me such stupid questions when this is manifesting itself right in front of your eyes? Like, how blind can you be? That isn't a time for questions about the meaning of life. The answer is right in front of you. And if you can't see it, it's not because life has no meaning. It's because you're blind. I mean, that's what the image of the Virgin Mother and the child is all about. It's like, what's the answer to the meaning of life? Here's an answer. It's like, well, I'm going to criticize that. Well, go right ahead. You know, it's like what you're like a what do you call that? A termite gnawing on a temple. There's no utility in that sort of criticism. It's blindness. And it's the same thing with regards to the path of the hero. It's like it glistens in front of you and you can criticize it. It's like, fine. Put the cart before the horse and see how far you get. So I thought to bring full closure to the class. I was trying to solve this terrible puzzle that confronted me for and many other people about how it was that human beings got themselves in such a tangle about what they believed. Such a tangle that we were pointing the ultimate weapons of destruction at one another, which, by the way, we are still doing. And I thought, okay, well, I understand that. We need our belief systems. They orient us. And that means there will be conflict between belief systems, and that can be a catastrophe. And that's being played out everywhere, again, in very many ways. What's the solution to that? Well, one possibility is there's no solution. It's just mayhem all the way around. Could be the case. But it seemed to me, as I delved into it, that the proper solution to that was to live properly as an individual, because you're more powerful than you think. Way more powerful than you think. I mean, God only knows what you are in the final analysis. You're blind to your own weaknesses, but you're also blind to your own strengths. And so then I think, well, if you got your act together, it'd be better for you, and instantly it would be better for your family, assuming they wanted you to get your act together, and not everyone does, but... And then it would be better for the community. It's like, how far could you take that? If you stopped wasting time, and if you stopped lying, and if you oriented yourself to the highest possible good that you could conceive of, and you committed to that, how much good could you do? Well, I would say, why don't you find out? So, that's what I think you should do. You should find out. You don't have anything better to do. And there's nothing in it, as far as I've been able to tell, there's nothing in it but good. So, maybe you could sort yourself out so that you wanted nothing but the good. And then maybe you could help make that manifest in the world. And maybe we wouldn't have all these terrible problems then. At least we'd have fewer of them, and that would be a start. So, it's the answer to the problem of humanity is the integrity of the individual. That's the answer. So, and states that are predicated on that realization are healthy. So, and states that aren't are doomed to stagnation and catastrophic collapse. And personalities that are predicated on self-tyranny and the tyranny of others are doomed to collapse. So, and then you think, well, what's the barrier? And the barrier is, are you willing to accept the responsibility? And part of the answer to that is, reduce the damn responsibility until it's tolerable. You don't have to fix everything at once. You could just start by fixing the things that you could fix. Or you could even do it more. You could do it with even less self-sacrifice. You could start by fixing only the things that you want to fix. God, you can get a massive way that way. So, do it. See what happens. That's what you should have been taught in university, right from the beginning. It's like, aim at the highest good. Tool yourself into something that can attain it. And go out there and manifest it in the world. And everything that comes your way will be... Everything that comes your way will be a blessing. And so, all you have to do is give up your resentment and your hatred. I know that's a hard thing to give up, because you have plenty of reason for it.
There's a reason why you have to change. The reason you have to change is because you're suffering unbearably.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that, is that that is the reason you have to change. If your life isn't everything that it could be, then you have to change. It's as simple as that, unless you want to continue the suffering. And so if you want to minimize the suffering and increase the quality of your life, then you want to welcome change through error whenever you can possibly manage it. Because being better is better than being who you are. It's as simple as that. Hmm. You want to be better than who you are, do you want to be who you are? Hmm. If you want to be better, then you welcome error. You say, bring it on. I'll try to listen. I'll try to make the changes as rapidly as I can without tearing myself into shreds, because sure, that can happen. You know, I mean, want to maintain some of your structure. But yeah, it's such an optimistic idea that it's the human capacity for eternal transformation that's the antidote to unbearable tragedy. It's like, wow, really? Really? Could that be true? And I'm no optimist, I'll tell you that. I'm no optimist. And so I've looked for optimistic truths that I could actually believe, and I actually believe that one. It's like you have no idea what, and you know, we know weird things. Here's something, for example. If I take you and put you in a new situation, mm-hmm. your brain produces new genes turn on and code for new proteins.
Right, okay.
It isn't just that you absorb new information from the surroundings and use that information to build yourself. It's that the new demands of the situation actually transform you at the micro level. They turn on, it's like a key has found a new lock.
Yeah.
And you have no idea how many things inside you could be turned on if you went everywhere you could go. Let me give you an example. This is so cool. This is mind-boggling. When I learned this, it just blew me away. So in the Chartres Cathedral, mm-hmm. there's a maze. Okay, now a cathedral is in the shape of a cross.
Yeah.
Okay, and a cross is a place where you could say the infinite meets the finite. It's a crossroads. Mm-hmm. And that's what a human being is, a place where the infinite meets the finite, like a genie. Okay, and the cross is a place of suffering because of the finitude. Okay, so that the cathedral's in the shape of a cross, and that's the solar cross as well. That's the place where everything comes together, and it's a place of suffering. So that's why Christ is hung on a cross. Okay, so then the question is, well, what do you do when you find yourself at the place of suffering? And that's the question about what you do in life. Hmm. Okay, so in the Chartres Cathedral, one answer to that is you go on a pilgrimage to the Holy City. You find the center of the world. Mm-hmm. Okay, but let's say you can't go on a pilgrimage because you don't have the money or the resources or whatever. You see, and when you go on a pilgrimage, you transform yourself because you go out of your village and you hit yourself against the world. And maybe you die, but if you don't die, when you come back, you're way more than you were. Okay, so...
Yeah. Sorry, Joseph Campbell's
It's the hero story.
Yeah, it's
sure, exactly.
Yeah, it's exactly the process of it, and it's the reason for it. It's what it's the personal growth that's involved in it, and the bringing back of the new knowledge from outside.
Yes, and the distribution of that knowledge to the community.
Yeah, for the benefit of others. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Exactly. That's the second part of the hero myth is that you not only do you go out and confront the dragon and get the gold, but you distribute it to the community. And if you're really good at it, then it multiplies.
Yeah.
So you actually don't even lose, you gain.
Yeah.
So now in the cathedral, there's a maze and it's shaped like a circle mm-hmm. and it's divided into four quadrants. And that's the whole world, north, west, east, and south. Okay, so you enter the maze at one side and it's a huge maze. You can walk it. You enter the maze at one side and then you have to walk every square inch of the maze quadrant by quadrant. So you have to go everywhere. And then you get to the center, and the center is a flower, like the Buddha's lotus. Mm-hmm. And so it's at the center of the cross. And so the idea that's built into the cathedral is that to overcome the tragedy that's associated with being at the crossroads of being, which is the conscious burden, you have to walk everywhere in the world, and that will bring you to the center. And what that means is if you walk everywhere in the world, you build yourself up into something that can withstand the tragedy of being without becoming corrupt. It's absolutely brilliant. It's brilliant. And it says what it says is that instantiated in a human being, in potential, are the tools and capabilities necessary to transcend the limitations of being and suffering as long as you fully utilize them. And you don't fully utilize them if you hide. Because if you're going to master snakes, you have to go out and confront the snakes. Mm. If you hide at home, then you shrivel. If you go out and if you go out into the world and confront the dragons of chaos, so to speak, wherever you can find them, intelligently, right?
Yeah,
and on your own terms, you're not a prey animal. You're a hunter. You're not a prey animal. You do it on your terms. Then that will transform you into something that can transcend tragedy. That's the central idea of Western civilization. It's an absolutely overwhelming idea. It's also that. And to put yourself at that place is also to put yourself in the place that's between chaos and order, and to speak chaos into order, and to reformulate order when it's been corrupt. It's all the same thing. It's all the stacking of this monomyth. And it's so positive. And people know this. It's like, okay, for example, in psychotherapy, it's not like this is a theory. We know it. If you take someone who's suffering from an anxiety disorder, you do the opposite of formulating for them a safe space. Mm-hmm. You say, okay, well, what are you afraid of that you're avoiding that's getting in your way? And they tell you, I'm really terrified about going in elevators, say. Say, okay, we say, well, let's take the elevator apart. Obviously, the elevator for you is a tomb of death.
Yeah.
It's something like that. It's like, okay, well, can you look at an elevator? And that's like looking at the brazen snake that God commanded Moses. Mm. Can you look at an elevator? No. Can you look at a picture of an elevator? Yes. Okay, well, let's look at a bunch of pictures of elevators until you're brave enough to look at them. Not until you're not afraid of them anymore. That's not the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's until, okay, good, I've looked at all those pictures. Okay, well, let's go out in the hallway and you can stand 100 feet away from the elevator and you can look at it. Think you can do that? Yeah. So you go out there with the person and you look at the elevator, and then they find out that they can actually look at the elevator, and then you get them 50 feet away. And then you get them 30 feet away. And then for the end session, you say, well, why don't you just touch the elevator doors and we'll call that a day. And they do that.
Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
And they go home and they think, ha, I'm a lot tougher than I thought I was. They don't think death and the elevator are less frightening.
Yeah.
They think, hey, there's a lot more to me than I thought. But encouragement is a good one because it means the installation of courage. It's not power. It's courage. And that's what you do with a child, if you have any sense as a parent too, is you encourage them. You don't say, the world isn't dangerous. It's like, are you crazy? The world will kill you.
Mm.
It is dangerous. And there are crazy people out there, and there are monsters everywhere. It's like, make no mistake. And so what
you're
do you
not
do
an optimist,
about,
are you?
Well, I'm an optimist in that what I tell, and I told my children this, is like, there are monsters out there, but you are a monster too.
Hmm.
Do not underestimate yourself. So you can go out there amongst the monsters of the world and prevail. And some of those monsters will then become your friend.
Well, you got to improve, right? And you might think, well, I'm a real fixer-upper and I'm really embarrassed about that because there's 50 things wrong with me, and like, look at that guy. And so now I feel all terrible because of the comparison and all of that. And first of all, it's unfair, because especially by the time you're about 30, like when you're 17, you're like every other 17-year-old. And so that kind of social comparison is more appropriate. By the time you're about 30, your life has become quite idiosyncratic, you know. Like, let's say your life has 8 dimensions: family, friends, intimate relationships, health, you know. You can kind of lay them out. You're individually positioned in all those dimensions. Your life isn't like anyone else's life. And so you see someone who's doing better than you. It's like you're only seeing one dimension at one slice of time. So it's not reasonable. You don't have the whole picture, you know. So, and then you get down on yourself and take the spirit out of yourself, and you get bitter and resentful. It's like, that, there's nothing good about that.
Yeah.
So, but you do need to improve, because there's more to you than, there's not as much of you as there should be. So what's the comparison? Well, that's easy. You just say, okay, well, here's my position in time and space right now. Here's my virtues and faults. It's like, I can be a little bit better tomorrow in some minor way. Well, that's the right comparison, because you are very much like you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Everything's the same about you.
Yeah.
And so it's the perfect comparison. And then you get a trajectory going. It's like, well, I obviously I'm not perfect, but I'm slightly less terrible than I was yesterday. Man, you keep that up for 5 years and you're wherever you should be. That isn't where someone else should be, right? Because you really are an individual. You just don't have insight into the tragedy of someone else's life. You know, and you might think, well, he's rich and successful. It's like, yeah, but you just don't know. You don't know what his relationship is with his wife or his children. You know, you don't know that he's gone through 2 divorces and his daughter won't talk to him and one of his kids is schizophrenic. And like, most people's lives are pretty nicely saturated with tragedy, you know, and with a certain degree of malevolence. And you might think, well, I'd trade places with him in a minute. And I'm also not saying that some people don't have it really rough. It's
of course,
like, look, man, some people have it rough.
Yeah.
That's not the point. It's not the point. The point is, you should be better than you are, but it's not because you're worse than other people. It's because you're not everything you should be. And so you got to pick the comparison right. And then that's also ennobling. It's like an instantly hopeful. There is absolutely no doubt that you can be slightly better tomorrow than you are today. And then because of the Pareto principle, that you know that movement towards the good increases exponentially, that trajectory can just take you out of hell very, very rapidly. And so you know, there's nothing but good about that.
Yeah.
There is definitely something that you can do today that will make you slightly better for the next day. Always. Always. Now, okay, not always. You're 85.
Right.
You have Alzheimer's. You know, you're done. Sometimes you're done. But most of the time you're not. And most of the time there's something within your grasp that you could put right. And see, that's the fundamental issue. It's like life is tragic. It's full of suffering and it's full of malevolence. There's no doubt about that. And it's brutal. And it's more brutal than you can even imagine in some ways or willing to imagine. But there's something you could put right. And we don't know what would happen if you put everything you could right, if you put it right. And then we don't know what would happen if everyone did that. But you can be certain that it would be less tragic and less malevolent. And so if you have a friend and you tell them bad news, they're actually sad. And you can tell them. They will listen. You know, they'll listen. They'll take the damn pain. And they won't tell you about some worse thing that happened to them, defensively, say. Or they won't secretly be happy that you got knocked off your pedestal. You know, they'll listen. And then the other thing is if you have a friend and something good happens to you, they're happy. Yeah, well, that's the thing is you, like, you know, if you're trying to quit smoking and your friends are offering you cigarettes, that's like, look, there's a joke. You can make a joke about that. And if it's a joke, it's fine. But often those sorts of jokes aren't jokes. It's right, like, they're... I'm smoking, you're quitting, you think you're better than me. It's like, can I get you to smoke? And then I don't have to be like embarrassed that I'm not able to do it. Or you're an alcoholic. And I think, yeah, you know, who cares about the fact that you've screwed up your third marriage? It's like, have another drink. Ha, ha, ha. It's like, no. It's, and the other thing, you know, people don't exactly understand that it's okay morally to choose people that are trying to help you be better and to shy away from people who are going to drag you down. So I this image always comes to mind for me. You know, if you're a lifeguard and you want to rescue someone who's drowning, the way you swim up to them is like this, with your foot out. And the reason is, well, maybe they're panicking, and two drowned people is not an improvement over one. So, you know, you don't have you're not morally obliged to go down with someone else's ship. Now, you think that's pretty harsh and pretty rude. You can't abandon a friend in need. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it is appropriate for you to look at your social surround and to make decisions. If you have a person who's hurting you, and who won't quit, and who's pulling you down, it's like, you don't have to, that is not necessary. You are not obligated to do that. You go with people that are trying to elevate you. Well, you actually are obligated to. It's like, you are not obligated to associate with people who are making your life worse, or who are even more, and I would say this more profoundly in some sense, you are obligated not to associate with people who are trying to damage the structure of being. Your being, so the family being, social being, all of that. It's like, no, wrong, move away. And you think, well, you know, that's cruel. It's like, it's not cruel. You're sending a message. This sort of behavior is not to be tolerated. Plus, if you make a success out of yourself, let's say that you develop your character, well, then you're an example. And at some point, maybe that's what that person is going to need, is an example. You know, maybe they'll hit bottom and think, oh my God, I'm not on the right path. It's like, there's an example I could follow. So, and you can't justify it by compassion, because often that's an excuse too. It's like, I'm hanging around with my drug addict, alcoholic friends because I want to help them. It's like, really, is that right? Maybe, right. Probably not though. You're not a saint, probably. Maybe you are.
Yeah.
But it's unlikely. One thing you want to think about with children, especially young children, this is really important. You got to get this right. When you have a baby, say, it's, you can't believe it. And you can't believe that you're going to be able to figure out what to do with this thing. Like, it's the most complicated thing you've ever had, and no one has helped you figure out how to do it. So you're stuck. And then like 3 months later, it's like, you can't really imagine what life would be like without that baby. And then it's sort of like, this goes on forever. That's how it feels, but it doesn't.
Right.
You have little kids for 4 years. And if you miss it, it's done. That's it. So you got to know that. It's, you know, lots of things in life you don't get to do more than once. Now, obviously, you can have more than one child, but all I'm saying is that period between 0 and 4, 0 and 5, there's something about it that's really, it's like a peak experience in life. And it isn't much of your life. You know, because you think of it as a long time. It's not that long, man. 4 years goes by so fast you can't believe it. And if you miss it, it's gone. So you miss it at your peril and you don't get it back. And that's not, I know it with your career, you miss opportunities, you fall behind. This happens to women a lot. It's part of the reason for the pay gap. And it's really hard on women, you know, although no one knows what to do about it. So, and I would also say, well, you talk to each other. Try to minimize your financial requirements to the degree that you can. See if there's other ways that you can generate income. But and do your come to a consensual solution and try not to torture yourself with guilt with whatever you come up with. But do remember, because you know, you've got financial responsibilities and often you need two incomes and there's no easy way of dealing with it. And for women, it often seems that no matter what they do, it's wrong, right? They stay home with their kids, it's wrong. If they go to work, it's wrong. If they do both, it's wrong. And I'm not being smart about that. Mm-hmm. That's rough, man. Mm-hmm. But having said all that, I would say again, you got little kids for 4 years. Don't miss it. You will regret it. Well, so then Geppetto shows up and he's a kindly old guy, which is pretty much exactly what you'd expect. And, you know, he's a careful craftsman and he likes kittens and, you know, that's always a good thing. And he has some fish and, you know, he's good at making things and he's got a sense of humor and he's kind of playful. And so he's the good father, fundamentally. He's the wise king. He's the positive archetype of the masculine. And that's what he is. And so he's culture in its positive manifestation. And he gives rise to this creation, which is his puppet, which is what culture does, because you're a puppet of your culture. You're a marionette of your culture. And so maybe you could be more than that. And that's the other thing that's strange about this movie, and it's strange about the mythological way of looking at the world, because scientifically, deterministically, there's nature and there's culture, and you are the deterministic product of the interaction between nature and culture. There's nothing else to you than that. That's that. But the mythological world doesn't say that. It says something different. It says that there's nature and culture, and then there's you. And the you that's in there has choices and a destiny, and that you actually affect the interplay of nature and culture in determining your own character. And it insists upon that, the oldest stories we have. There's always the hero and the archetypal mother and the archetypal father. There's always those three things. There's never just two. So from the narrative perspective, there's always the implication that there's something autonomous about the hero of the story. And, you know, you can't account for that. We don't have a good way of accounting that for that from a scientific perspective. I was having a discussion with Sam Harris the other day, which was very, what would you say? He said we got wrapped around an axle, which is pretty much, Sam Harris is one of the four famous, you know, atheists, along with Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and Dan Dennett, yeah. And so we were having a discussion and he's a determinist, just right down to the bottom. It's like you're determined, there's no free will. You're a deterministic machine. And, you know, if you're a coherent scientist and you're a Newtonian, roughly speaking, you don't really have much choice other than to think that way. But that isn't how it seems to people. And we don't treat each other that way. And our entire legal system is predicated on the idea that you do, in fact, have free will. So, well, can we account for it? Well, no. And do we have a scientific model for it? No. But then I would also say we do not have a scientific model for consciousness. We don't know a damn thing about consciousness, which is why Dan Dennett's book, which was called Consciousness Explained, was referred to by its critics as Consciousness Explained Away, which is exactly right as far as I'm concerned, because he took a mechanistic approach, and I just don't think you get to do that, because there's something really weird about consciousness. I mean, the phenomenologists like Heidegger, who tried to radically transform Western philosophy right from the bottom up, he basically said, well, you know, you can treat the world as if consciousness is primary and that human experience is reality. That's reality. and that it doesn't exist independently of consciousness in any explicable way. It's like, well, what's out there if there's nothing to experience it? Well, everything at once. It's something like that. It's not really comprehensible as without a subject. The subject defines it and makes it real. Now, you don't have to believe that, but at least I'm telling you that there are thoroughly coherent philosophical positions that make that case very strongly, and that allow consciousness to exist as a phenomena and to take it seriously. And you certainly act like you take it seriously. You act like there's a you and that you make choices, and you certainly treat other people that way. Deterministic or not, you're still going to get angry when they're being, you know, rude to you, and you're going to act as if they had some choice in the matter. Now, maybe that's an illusion, possibly, but maybe it's not. And I would say the oldest stories that we have always include that as not only a fundamental element, but even as the fundamental element.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.